The race is on. The development of not just one, but several COVID-19 vaccines has been an astonishing scientific accomplishment. The world's nations now face the daunting logistical challenge of distributing them, the complex ethical questions of prioritizing them, and the likely infernal political arguments ignited by both. The countries which get it done fastest will buy themselves considerable advantages. They'll be able to open up their domestic economies, re-engage with the world, and burnish a reputation for competence. They'll have done good and looked good doing it. But should it be a competition? This is a global crisis. Shouldn't the world be working together? Or is there an argument that those who help themselves first will be best placed to help others later? And perhaps most importantly, will they? This is the Foreign Desk.
In some parts of the U.S., prisons and prison staff are being vaccinated. In other states, the governors have said, no, we're not doing that because they don't like prisoners, basically, even though that's a high-risk population. I've talked to a lot of people who run group homes for intellectually disabled people, not in nursing homes or care homes, but out in the community. They're getting no supply. They got forgotten.
פריצת דרך שתוציא אותנו מהקורונה ותחזיר אותנו לחיים.
As of now, there's no Israeli-sponsored Palestinian vaccination program. What is interesting, though, is the skepticism and the hesitation of getting vaccinated among the Palestinians is very high.
Initially, when there were fears that the U.S. was going to monopolize all of the vaccine supply, the European Union cast itself as almost sort of this vaccine superhero that was going to procure shots not just for all of Europe, but potentially all of the world. Now that we've seen production and supply challenges, unfortunately, we do see these altruistic ambitions deteriorating a little bit.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests today are Sarah Wheaton and Dr. Arthur Kaplan. Sarah Wheaton is Chief Policy Correspondent for Politico Europe. She joins us from Brussels. And Arthur Kaplan is Professor of Bioethics at New York University's School of Medicine. He joins us from the woods of Connecticut. In this first part of the show, I want to talk more domestically about what the responsibilities and duties and possibilities are in terms of vaccinations and how domestic governments go about organizing them. The second part of the show will talk more about the global picture. But Sarah, I'll start with you. Notwithstanding the United Kingdom, which is actually proceeding with the vaccinations at a reasonably impressive clip, are the non-UK European countries actually being too slow by half? They seem to have got off to a very sluggish start.
Indeed, and it's causing quite a bit of domestic problems around the bloc, and as well, it's also calling into question European Union's unity. In fact, there's a huge Blame Brussels faction basically saying that the EU was too slow to buy doses compared to the United States and the United Kingdom. On the other hand, you also see that many countries, including Germany, which has been one of the most vocal in criticizing Brussels, is not doing a very good job of getting the doses out that they have.
Is it just a question of poor organization, if you will? I mean, if we focus on one specific example, you look at a country like the Netherlands, which would appear to have every imaginable advantage where doing something like this is concerned. It is geographically tiny, it is rich, it is well organized. You would think vaccinating the Netherlands would be relatively straightforward as these things go. And yet, one, they have barely started, and two, the government has picked this moment to resign en masse over something else entirely.
Right. I think it's really fascinating if you look at the databases that lay out how countries have been doing with their vaccination. There are some things that show number of doses administered per 100. And there's not an obvious pattern. So, yeah, it sort of makes sense that UK and Denmark are doing very well. But then you have Italy, you have Spain, you have Slovenia and Lithuania in the top 10, whereas you have big, wealthy countries like Germany and France and the Netherlands, as you mentioned, doing quite poorly. And each country is a precious snowflake with a health system and a value set that really drive this. So one of the factors in the Netherlands, and that may be the case in many countries, is At one point, it looked like the AstraZeneca vaccine was the front runner. That was both the cheapest and the most logistically simple. It doesn't need kind of special freezing or transportation. So I think the Netherlands was a country where they were more banking on that particular shot being the one that was available. So they didn't think as much about how they were going to be doing the logistics for a more complicated mRNA vaccine. In Germany, they say actually part of the issue is that Germany has many different health insurance systems. And so the data about who actually qualifies for this vaccine is not consistently available. Whereas in countries like Spain and Italy, you maybe do have, and certainly in the United Kingdom, where you have the National Health Service, you have very centralized data system.
Arthur, another thing that countries have had a long time to think about is the order in which they roll the vaccines out. Obviously, who gets it first? You can't vaccinate everybody the same week. Does it strike you that there's much in the way of interesting or indicative divergence in who is prioritising what? Here in the UK, of course, where credit where it's due to the government, as we were saying, they're doing quite well, but they started out with old people, care homes, people with chronic illnesses, which might make them more vulnerable. Is that the smart thing to do? I wonder myself whether more thought should be given to vaccinating people like retail workers, bus drivers, refuse collectors, delivery people, the ones who have to interact with the public and the ones without whom society really would grind to a halt.
Yeah, well, we spent an inordinate amount of time in the U.S. arguing over who should go first, who should go second, and who should go third. Lots of categories, federal advice flying around about prioritization. But we learned a couple of things. Once the vaccine went to the states, they all decided their own priorities. So in some parts of the U.S., prisons and prison staff are being vaccinated. In other states, the governors have said, no, we're not doing that because they don't like prisoners, basically, even though that's a high-risk population and could be a place where the virus easily spreads back to the community. I've talked to a lot of people who run group homes for intellectually disabled people, not in nursing homes or care homes, but out in the community. They're getting no supply. They got forgotten. So on the list, despite lots and lots of arguing, if you had a clientele of Down syndrome individuals, their death rates are 6, 7, 8 times as high as everybody else, but somehow left off the prioritization list. So we did spend a lot of time arguing, but now we have 50 states with 50 different policies. We've seen a little cheating as a result, because when you don't have consistency, people start to say that I'm not going to follow the rules. So we have people who are rich flying to Florida to get in line to get vaccinated, because Florida, per usual, doesn't seem to care exactly who's supposed to be a priority. They're, Lord help us, they're even vaccinating Canadians there who are down there as snowbirds. So that's causing tension among the locals. But here's the take-home lesson that I learned. It's great to have these arguments about who goes first. If your logistics don't work, it doesn't matter what your list is. If you can't get supply out to the meat packers or the delivery people or wherever, if what we do is we send the supply to hospitals and nursing homes or care homes, as we've done here, that's where the vaccinations occur. And those institutions will just vaccinate their employees, high risk or not, because that's where the refrigerator is. As Sarah said, it's hard to handle this stuff. They're not going to go running down the street looking for the next category of person to give it to. So logistics, as much as ethics or laying out priority groups, drives distribution.
Just to follow that up quickly, Arthur, is there, I mean, obviously, as you've just been explaining, there's any number of different approaches that you could take, and these things are probably going to end up being governed and directed by politics, as everything always is. But is there, if you wanted to, just an absolutely ruggedly utilitarian calculus you could apply to this, even if it did, for example, mean that maximum security prisoners got vaccinated ahead of entirely virtuous frail elderly people?
Yeah, there is. I mean, what we know about these vaccines, the two approved ones at least, Pfizer and the Moderna ones, is that there's data that shows they're very effective in preventing death and preventing sickness. Whether they're that good at preventing transmission from person to person, we're not so sure. Maybe the AstraZeneca or the soon-to-be-approved Johnson & Johnson one will do better. But the ones we have prevent death. So if that's what they can do, then you're not just watching transmission, you're trying to pay attention to death prevention, and that's how we get the risk groups that we do. So there is a utilitarian calculus. It basically says take the groups most likely to die and vaccinate them. That's pretty much the principle. If it turns out that there's protection against transmission as well from these or soon to be here vaccines, I think the calculus will shift and we'll start to say, let's watch those delivery people. Let's watch those people have a lot of public contact because that will help us reduce transmission. But right now, I hate to put it bluntly, but it's a prevent death calculus.
Sarah, one factor which is going to make even applying that calculus difficult in some places is going to be a potential reluctance among populations to actually accept the vaccine. According to some polls, only 40% of people in France have said they are willing to take a vaccine. Now, even allowing for the fact that a certain amount of that might be bluster and obstreperousness and just unwillingness to sound, unnecessarily cooperative with polling people. Does any government appear to have a coherent strategy in place for what happens if a critical mass of the population just won't take it?
We're not quite there yet as far as a forward-looking strategy, but what I can say is that concern about vaccine hesitancy has infused every aspect of the process in Europe. So, for example, the approval for these vaccines has come much slower from the European Medicines Agency than from the US regulator or the UK regulator. And that's because Europe chose to stick with what's called a conditional marketing authorization instead of an emergency authorization, which means that they did a much more thorough data check. There are a lot of requirements for the drug maker to come back with more data. And it just took longer. And that was partly out of concern that vaccine hesitancy is already so high in Europe. Likewise, there's been some hesitancy among some governments to really force people or to be too aggressive about giving out the vaccine. They kind of want to have a very light touch because they don't want to inflame conspiracy theories and anger among the public. That is an issue that we've seen in France. Likewise, European negotiations to buy the vaccines were slower, and that's because Europe didn't want to let the drug companies off the hook for liability if something goes wrong. They do have more protections in the United States and in the UK than they do in Europe. So there's sort of a policy victory in Europe. It came at the expense of the vaccines coming more slowly, and indeed, hesitancy is also creating a somewhat more passive distribution process.
Sarah Wheaton and Arthur Kaplan, thank you both very much for the moment. We'll have more from you both later in the show. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. As we go to air, the country which has made the greatest strides with vaccinations is Israel, which has already administered around 25 doses per 100 people. Well, joining us from Tel Aviv to explain how Israel has done it is Alison Kaplan-Sommer, journalist with Haaretz.
I think that there are two factors that have worked really strongly in Israel's favor. And we've had a winning combination of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's approach and personality and the way that the Israeli healthcare system is structured. Netanyahu is probably one of the most established and recognizable world leaders. So when he calls a CEO of a pharmaceutical company, he usually can get them on the phone, and he has got very polished powers of persuasion. He's been at this early. He was in the vaccine game at a very early stage, placing orders, making sure that Israel was high on the priority list. A lot of the details of that are classified, but we're told that Israel has been paying a premium for the vaccine far more than the United States and Britain has paid. But I think that, you can overemphasize Netanyahu's role because the way the Israeli healthcare system is structured, set up, and has grown over the years is very conducive to getting the vaccines in people's arms efficiently. On one hand, it's a completely public system. We have a network of four or five very large HMOs, and people can choose which one to sign up for. The government gives each HMO a certain amount of money based on each person. So there's a competitive element there. And these health organizations are competing for customers, which means they try to be as service-oriented and as efficient and as community-friendly as possible. So they're highly highly digitized. You have a magnetic card that has all of your information on it. You're always communicating with them through texts, through emails, if you want, through the telephone. So it's a national system, but it doesn't operate like a massive national bureaucracy. It operates like very small competitive companies. And so that's been very efficient at delivering the vaccines. Each HMO was already set up for mass vaccination each year for flu shots. They've been very aggressive in getting their populations to have flu shots because they obviously save money when their population doesn't get the flu in en masse. So they basically took these arrangements that they already had for flu shots and put them on steroids. I'm told the government hired event organizing companies, the kind that make major conferences. And so we have these huge sports stadiums, event centers, conference centers, even some like huge tents in public parks and squares, and they allot space to each HMO, and each HMO sets itself up inside. Every single day, more and more locations were opening up, so more and more people were able to get vaccinated. And because everything is digitized and the HMO has access to all their information, it was a very quick process for them to easily pick and choose who should get invited to vaccinate.
Do you think there is a sort of national mindset at play here as well? It's noticeable that quite a few of the countries which have had better than average COVID-19 outcomes, you might think of Taiwan or South Korea, also have in the collective consciousness a background in national military service and also perhaps having to respond collectively and quickly to a menace to the entire country.
Israelis are very good at scrambling quickly in emergencies. I've been joking that they don't call it the Six-Day War for nothing. And so this sort of vaccination mission very much plays into the Israeli mentality of, okay, you know, quickly, let's get organized and get this done. What is not good at is long-term discipline and systems. And the trick with fighting COVID has been to get everybody basically to sit home and do nothing. Israelis have been bad at that. They're very social people. They're very active. People. So what we've got going on right now is sort of a simultaneous huge uptick in infections. And we've got, again, this very quick moving, successful vaccination operation. So as of yet, and we're hoping very soon, the vaccination will start to put a dent in the infection rates, which are really still very troubling right now.
Is there any talk, even out of base self-interest, of extending the vaccination program to the Palestinians in Gaza and on the West Bank?
Well, Israelis kind of feel like they're getting an unfair rap on that. The Palestinian Authority has said that it wants to take responsibility itself to vaccinating Palestinians, even though their infrastructure is far poorer and they have far less advantages than the Israelis do in getting the vaccines. Obviously, they wouldn't turn away Israeli vaccines if it were offered to them, but they have said that they're responsible for it. And actually, technically, they are. With the Oslo Accords in the 1990s, vaccinations were kind of one of the things that the Palestinians were supposed to be responsible for in their own population. But Israel does have an interest, once it feels like its own population is vaccinated and under control, in getting the Palestinian population, especially in the West Bank, vaccinated, because there is a huge interplay between the two populations. Many Palestinians work in Israel, and so they're going to look to getting the Palestinians vaccinated at some point soon. But as of now, there's no Israeli sponsor Palestinian vaccination program. What is interesting, though, is the skepticism and the hesitation of getting vaccinated among the Palestinians is very high. Inside Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, their cities and towns have the lowest rate of vaccinations of these over 60 populations. In Jerusalem, for example, Palestinian East Jerusalem residents who don't have to be Israeli citizens to get vaccinated, only about 20% of them have received their coronavirus vaccine. The same population in the city's Jewish population has been vaccinated 75%. So there's also a big cultural difficulty going on there as well.
That was Alison Kaplan-Sommer with Haaretz. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sarah Wheaton and Dr. Arthur Kaplan. In this part of the show, I want to talk a bit about how the process of vaccination might end up reshaping the planet and the way in which the planet's constituents, countries, interact with each other. Arthur, first of all, you've written about something you referred to as vaccine nationalism. What do you mean by that?
Vaccine nationalism We coined the term, I and a colleague of mine, with the idea that many people believe you should vaccinate your own country first and then turn to worrying about helping other countries that might not have vaccine. Think of it as the airline mask policy: put on your own mask before you help others or help your children so that you're able to do so. The opposite position at the extreme is vaccine cosmopolitanism, which says every life is worth saving. It doesn't matter what country you're in. You should distribute vaccine where you get the best bang for the buck internationally. WHO, many international groups sound often like they are vaccine cosmopolitans. They basically say we've got to buy vaccine and make sure that the poor nations have it, lower and middle income nations have it. My own view is, I think vaccine nationalism to some degree makes sense. You have to take care of your own most at risk, your own populations that are necessary for the healthcare workforce to function and so on. And then you worry about forming programs to aid other nations.
But Sarah, if we look specifically at the EU, is vaccine nationalism an approach that's going to make sense? If you are part of continental Europe in particular, doesn't pretty much everybody have to be vaccinated to make the vaccinations useful?
Well, we've seen kind of an interesting evolution in the rhetoric coming from Brussels. So initially, when there were fears that the US was going to monopolize all of the vaccine supply, the European Union cast itself as almost sort of this vaccine superhero that was going to procure shots, not just for all of Europe, but potentially all of the world as well. Now that we've seen production and supply challenges, they're certainly stressing that everybody in the European Union will have access to vaccines at around the same rate. But when you hear the Commission talk about the vaccines that they're going to distribute outside of the EU, they're more stressing things in the immediate neighborhood. And it sounds like it is going to be quite a bit longer time before poor countries do get vaccines from Europe. And it's been interesting to see that there's less and less confidence in this sort of international COVAX effort to buy vaccines for poor countries. We just saw the African Union in the past few days secure about 300 million doses. We're seeing India kind of increasingly take charge of its own supply. So unfortunately, we do see these sort of altruistic ambitions deteriorating a little bit.
Arthur, is that perhaps, though, where the oxygen mask analogy falls down? I mean, what happens if we reach a point, if we pursue this idea of vaccine nationalism, and we reach a point at which we are conspicuously vaccinating German university students before we vaccinated Indian healthcare workers?
Yeah, my position would be you take the most at risk, you take the population in your country, U.S., UK, Europe, whatever country you're talking about, and make sure that you take care of them. You don't have to worry quite as much about the university student. In fact, these vaccines aren't even available and proven yet for children. And so you take the low-risk people later. I think you start offering aid and help as soon as you get through, let's call it the neediest groups and the groups that are required for society to function, get your economy going and so on. It's a big number. Probably in the US, it would be half the population might fit that. But once you're done there, then you start making sure that you're doing something for the rest of the world, because obviously, if these vaccines can prevent transmission, you want to control outbreaks, you want to tamp down the epidemic all over the world.
Sarah, there's going to be issues to be confronted here for Europe in terms of migration potentially as well, aren't there? I mean, we already have a situation in which one of the most live political issues in Europe is the situation of people leaving poor or less functional countries for a more agreeable life in Europe. If the prospect of being able to escape COVID-19 or perhaps being able to access a vaccine becomes a factor, the two probabilities there are, one, that it increases the numbers of people, and two, finds the European Union actually obliged in a way that it has not been before to take a harder line on migrants.
Yeah, we're not seeing that play out too much and so far, but I can definitely see that coming down the pike. But one note of caution that I would offer here, when we cover health policy, we see a lot of parallels with the COVID-19 discussion, with older discussions about HIV. And there's a perception in Europe where migrants disproportionately have HIV compared to the native population, let's say. There's a perception that these migrants are bringing HIV from wherever they're coming from. But when you actually study these people, you find that they ended up becoming infected with HIV after they already arrived in Europe. So it may be that there will be more pressure on European countries to make sure that these camps where people are all packed together, that they have better sanitation there and that sort of thing. But the idea that people from poor countries are going to be coming in pursuit of vaccines or potentially spreading the disease around Europe. They have many other reasons to be escaping where they're from and coming to a prosperous place like Europe beyond escaping COVID. One thing that I do find really interesting is it seems like we have vaccines for rich countries or vaccines for wealthy countries, Western countries, I should say, versus vaccines for the global south, and those are coming from China and Russia. There are a lot of questions about the efficacy of those vaccines. And so I think that will be another factor playing out, is sort of having inequality of vaccination around the world.
I mean, we were talking earlier, Arthur, about vaccine nationalism. Do you see vaccine diplomacy also becoming a thing?
Oh, yeah. China clearly is running around the world offering vaccine, partly out of humanitarian hopes, but partly out of politics and trying to build alliances and trying to take advantage of American weakness on the international scene. So absolutely. And I think Sarah's right. We'll see vaccine diplomacy play out in two ways. One, if you got another vaccine that is, if you will, better evidence-based than the ones China is offering right now, but let's say it only worked at 70% efficacy, but it was easier to store and only took one shot, is that the one you're going to offer to poor countries as opposed to heavy refrigeration, 95% efficacy, but two shots? Similarly, it's pretty clear to me that the ability to study vaccines in big trials to get more evidence is collapsing. That's because as soon as vaccines become available, people don't want to sign up to be in studies of them anymore, at least in the Western countries. Are we going to export the studies of the next round of vaccines to the poor nations, basically saying, we don't have anything, so let us give half of you a vaccine to see if that one works, because there are many more vaccines coming through the pipeline. They're not going to get studied in the US or Europe because people are just going to say, I want the proven vaccines or the emergency released ones or the ones that are available. I'm not going to be in a trial.
There's a point there I want to come back to conclude the program, Arthur. But before we get to that, Sarah, do you perceive within the EU any sense of not necessarily flag waving or chest puffing, but any amount of competition between the countries, a sense that whoever gets this done first and most quickly will kind of have got one over on everybody else? I ask that particularly because here in the United Kingdom, which again, credit where due, does seem to be doing quite well, there has been a very thinly veiled suggestion from the government that this somehow wouldn't have been quite as possible had the UK not left the EU.
Right. And you know what? To be really honest, that argument is not totally false. And it's a super interesting thing for everybody to watch. And I think that people in Brussels and in the European capitals are very aware that they need to show, because again, as I mentioned, approval in Europe has been slower. Whether they bought the right mix of vaccines remains a question. And so, yes, there is certainly competition among EU countries, but I would almost say that you have the Brexit dynamic of EU versus UK definitely emerging. The one question will be is, at some point, is there going to be rebellion in the UK about the price that the UK paid? Also, some big questions about the liability protections. If there does end up being a problem with this vaccine down the line, then that will be Europe's chance to be like, oh, well, we took longer to prove it and we are going to hold the company accountable. But if all these vaccines continue to work great and the earlier access to the AstraZeneca vaccine in the UK leads that country to kind of be able to emerge from lockdown earlier than everybody else, that's going to be a big win, certainly at least rhetorically and probably practically for the government.
At which, and finally, Arthur, I wanted to go back to that scenario you conjured of different parts of the world getting different access to vaccines at different times. And I suspect I know the answer to this question, but do feel free to pleasantly surprise our listeners. Is there any imaginable way that the basic upshot of all this isn't going to be that the countries which were already wealthy and functional get further ahead, while the less wealthy and less functional countries fall further behind?
No.
On that, I suspect, accurate but depressing note, Arthur Kaplan and Sarah Wheaton, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffin and Christy Evans. The studio manager was Steph Chungu. Christy Evans also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.